And it does strike me also, as you know, as we've moved beyond the pandemic, of not trying to write loads and loads of rules like we know what we're all going to be doing, but to drive much more from a sense of principles. And that is something I've long believed and long talked about, that we need to drive businesses more from principles of what we believe, our values, our purpose, the principles of things that we think are important, and less from great long lists of rules and policies and practices.
Hey everyone, it's great to be talking to you again, and a very warm welcome to episode 27 of the show. In this episode, we are very fortunate to be joined by Peter Cheese. Peter is the Chartered Institute of Personnel and Development's Chief Executive. He writes and speaks widely on the development of HR, the future of work, and the key issues of leadership, culture, organisation, people and skills. He's a companion of the Institute of Leadership and Management, the Chartered Management Institute, and the British Academy of Management. He's a visiting professor at the University of Lancaster and sits on the advisory board for the University of Bath Management School. Prior to joining the CIPD in July 2012, he was the chairman of the Institute of Leadership and Management and a member of the Council of City and Guilds. Up until 2009, he had a long career at Accenture, holding various leadership positions and culminating in a seven-year spell as the Global Managing Director, leading the firm's human capital and organisation consulting practice. In this episode, Peter talks extensively about the future of work, making work more human, and how we simply must ensure we don't go back to normal post-COVID-19. He describes the challenges and problems of the pre-COVID-19 workplace, unsurprisingly, better than anyone I've heard, and gives some incredibly insightful advice for all of us going forwards. So, without any further delay, please enjoy my interview with Peter Cheese. Hello, Peter. A very warm welcome to this episode of the podcast. Let me just start off, if I can, by asking how you're doing today and whereabouts are we talking to you from?
Yeah, good morning, Ben. You're talking to me from home, like so many of us, of course, and my home is in the countryside near the Surrey Hills, just north of Guildford. So I've been very lucky, I think, particularly during the lockdown, to have the freedom to be able to go out of the house and go for walks and cycle rides. And that has been a massive blessing. And I know how fortunate I am in that regard.
That's good to hear. And Peter, as the current CEO of the CIPD, can you just share a little with our listeners about how your career journey has shaped you as a leader and sort of what stand out for as perhaps the two or three main leadership lessons you've learned along the way that would be valuable to share with other people?
Yeah, I think the thing that's so much shaped a lot of what I do and how I think is people. It's people at work, and it's how we interact and how we engage and motivate others and how we share and build organizations together. And I sometimes describe myself as a humanist. And if I go all the way back to my university education, I studied ergonomics at university at Loughborough, which really is actually about the combination of people in the system, if you will, the system of work and how people interact with technology and all of those things. And it's sort of provided a bit of a symmetry in the sense that running now the professional body for HR and people development, it is so much about that in my view, in terms of the future of work and how we really do make sure that our thinking is people-centered, so that, you know, the future of work is profound and profoundly needs to be human. So those have been the sort of principles, I suppose, that have shaped so much of what I've done, and certainly linked to that thought is therefore also this idea of the evolution of work and how technology and other things are impacting that, which I'm sure we'll come back to in this podcast. And in terms of my own leadership, therefore, what I hope I've always done is to bring a sense of empathetic leadership and ability to listen and to coach and support. And one of my overriding values as I think about leadership, and it was something I learned at Accenture, because where I spent many years, because it was one of their six core values, is the idea of stewardship. And stewardship has many meanings, but I think as a leader in particular, it has the meaning of being a steward to those that come behind you, helping people to develop and progress. And I think there's nothing more rewarding in doing that. But also, of course, stewardship to the organization that you lead, and recognizing, you know, that old saying of you want to leave things better than you found them. And then however you do that, that I think are very important guiding principles of leadership and what leaders do.
Peter, I'm going to go off piste straight away with the questions, which is becoming a real habit of mine on this show. But you mentioned quite a lot just then the word human. I think you said kind of you're a humanness, kind of building workplaces that are more human, which is interesting because one of the things I personally believe on a fundamental level and talk a lot about in terms of leadership is that I really believe the job of a leader is to deliver the results and to look after the people that we've got the sort of privilege and responsibility to lead. Yeah. But I wonder from what you just said, do you think there was a point at which leadership, in inverted commas, sort of stopped being quite so human? And if so, when, why, and what do you think we can do to get back to a slightly more human approach?
Yeah, I think there was a time in that regard, Ben. So yes, absolutely, to reinforce the point, when I talked about all those things about, you know, putting people first, I mean, of course, it's also in service of results. I mean, you're trying to help people to give of their best. And if they give of their best, then you're, of course, going to deliver on that other critical thing that leaders need to do, which is you're delivering on performance of the organization, innovation, and all those other things which are now so important. But yeah, to answer your question, I've studied and thought about this a lot. I've talked a great deal about leadership over the years. And if I go back to the early stages of my career, where, you know, in the 80s and 90s, I think we were very much in, not in every sector. I mean, one has to make, I suppose, some distinctions to some degree in certain parts of our economy, but very large parts of business thinking, certainly commercial business thinking, it's very much about the profit motive. And indeed, I often quote Milton Friedman, the American economist, who in the 1970s said that, you know, the sole purpose of business is to make money. And I honestly do think that was very much the mantra which drove an awful lot of business thinking through the 80s and 90s and even early noughties. That actually, yeah, we were there to make money for the shareholder. It wasn't so much about the people. The people were assets, and we even use that terminology of people as our most important assets, or human resources, or human capital. So I think absolutely that those sorts of latter decades of the 20th century and even the early part of the 21st century, I think, were dominated much more by a culture of thinking of command and control, write lots of rules, because, you know, the problem is with people is they won't always do what you want them to do. So you write lots of rules, as I say, command and control. You're not really interested in other more human outcomes like well-being and emotional stuff. I mean, in the end, you're paying people to do a job of work, and that was very much the belief. And that the overall driver for so much of private enterprise, if you will, was to make money. Now we're shifting forwards into a world where we talk a lot more about things like multi-stakeholder capitalism, because I think those beliefs that had led us in many ways to what we just described have even led us now, as we look back on those decades, to think that, well, maybe capitalism itself is not quite working as we'd want it, and the growing inequalities in society and the growing inequalities of opportunity. And hence, as I said, the shift now towards this idea of much more multi-stakeholder capitalism, and the idea that business of any kind has responsibility to more than just its financial owner or stakeholders. It has responsibility, of course, to its people, its employees, to its customers, to its suppliers, to the communities of which we are part, and certainly also, of course, to the environment. And those, I think, are principles now which are shaping a different way of thinking about business and business responsibility, and therefore also, of course, of what we expect of leaders.
Yeah, and that brings us nicely, Peter, back on track with my question. So thank you. I think there's been a lot of discussion lately, understandably so, about the future of work, especially with regards to where people will work, be that at home, the office, a blend of two. And I also read your editorial piece in the March issue of People Management magazine on the topic. I think it's probably fair to say, sort of regardless of how often people will be in offices, I think there's going to be a time when people will be working back in offices again. And with that in mind, bear in mind that that might come sort of in the summer, June, July, September for us here in the UK at least. What do you think leaders should be doing, thinking about, working on now so that the organisations they are leading are really ready to welcome people back, make people feel safe, and sort of enable them to give of their best when they come back to our places of work?
Yeah, there's a lot that needs to be thought through. I mean, some people have described, of course, the pandemic as the biggest experiment in home working that we've ever had. I mean, who could have predicted all of this in terms of this enormous shift that organizations everywhere had to make towards supporting people working from home? But leading into it, before I sort of answer the question in a sense, is also, so what is it that we think that with these perhaps different ways of working, not only what have we learned through the pandemic, but what was going on before the pandemic that we have learned as a result could therefore really be a shift in how we work? And what I mean by that is, if you think about so much of what was happening in the world of work, we had this growing sense of stress in the workplace. And as the CIPD, we've done a lot of work on this, and we've steadily seen the growth of people feeling stressed at work, the workloads, the sense of presenteeism, which had become so endemic, that I'm being judged more by the hours that I input and how visible I am than actually what I output. We've also seen things like, you know, at best, engagement plateauing. We talked a lot about the challenges of productivity and how we improve that. So, you know, to go back to the fundamental principles we started this podcast on, you know, how do we get more out of our people in the right ways? We've seen the steady rise, partly because of stress, of the concerns about mental health and well-being. We've seen the concerns about lack of progress and diversity and inclusion. And these are really, really big themes which have been steadily growing in the world of work in recent years. So my fundamental belief is that we have to use this opportunity of the pandemic to make some significant changes. And I don't think we'll ever get a better opportunity, because so many of the paradigms of work that we, you know, that we know and have lived with through most of our working lives have been around forever. I mean, 5-day working weeks, Monday to Friday, standard jobs, standard hours, all those sorts of things. And that when we talk about other forms of working, flexible working and so forth, they're non-standard or non-routine. And then we find actually there's quite a lot of bias, inherent bias, almost against these different forms of working. We're seeing, for example, or, you know, this is leading up until the pandemic, we'd seen that many people who were working more part-time, incidentally, which tend to be more women than men, feeling that they weren't getting a fair crack of the whip, and that they were somehow being perceived as less committed. Or we've had this language which is only meant half in jest, that, well, somebody's shirking from home and not working from home, which just speaks volumes as to, as I said, a long-standing culture of presenteeism. So the pandemic, as I said, has taught us many things. It's taught us that we can work in these different ways, that we can trust our people to work when they're not as visible to us, that we can measure and understand people and what they do far more on output and not just how many hours they might be inputting. We've also learned much more about the absolute centrality of the idea of well-being and looking after our people and putting our people first. And I hear that very, very consistently. And we've learned that we can work, therefore, also in these more agile and flexible ways. Now, with all of that said, it's very important also to recognize that the number or the proportion of the workforce that was working from home, even at its absolute peak in the first big wave of the pandemic, was slightly less than half. So we still have many, many jobs that require people to be in workplaces. And also that interestingly, many of those jobs, so-called essential jobs, tended to be the ones which are perhaps slightly lower paid, sometimes more the more low-skilled jobs. So it's also shone a big light on these issues of equality and fairness and what we would take to be truly essential jobs and how we should perhaps better recognize and better support them and frankly pay them better as well. So those are enormous learnings as we think about how we, as you said, emerge from the pandemic. What do we do that's different? What are we going to take forward to the learnings of these this last year? And to use that phraseology, you know, genuinely build back better. And I do think this is an era-defining moment. I think there is a real opportunity, therefore, for leaders to think about all those issues and then say, okay, so what I really want to do is to build on that idea of putting people first. I want to give people as much as I can more choice about where and how they work. And I've got to make sure that's fairly balanced to include those people who have to have, have to be in a place of work. That we look and put well-being much more front and center, that we learn that the ways in which we communicated with our people, supported them, even broken down some of the status and hierarchies and so forth that we've had to do because we're all, staring into each other's living rooms and things. All of those things need to be taken forward. But it's not going to be simple, and I wouldn't want people to think that my message here is, well, just do what you were doing during the pandemic. No, to come back to an environment where we will allow more flexibility and where and how people work, when they come into the offices and things like that, will take some real thinking about how do you create hybrid ways of working which can support people in more of their choice about where and how they work, but still keep the cohesion of the organization, make sure that we're all connecting in the ways that we need to, even when we're combining both physical connection and virtual connection. And as I said, these fundamental ideas of fairness, there's a big thing for us to think through. But we cannot miss this opportunity, in my view. I really troubles me when I hear business leaders increasingly see that commentary and saying, well, we all need to get back to the office because that's the only way we work, that's the only way we connect, all the water cooler and serendipitous moments of innovation, et cetera, et cetera. And that cannot be what we have learned from this pandemic. It really can't. We've got to think differently and build a better world of work for the future.
Yeah, I passionately agree, Peter, with everything you've just said. And I wonder, do you have any, you or the CIPD, have any particular insights about what we can do to try and ensure that we don't just default to going back to the old normal, in inverted commas? Because by the time lots of us are back working in offices, that's potentially going to be 18 months of working from home, which, mm-hmm. looking at various bits of research, that's certainly long enough to create some new habits, but it's potentially not long enough to sort of erode, decouple old habits that have been built up over 20, 30 years. Do you have any thoughts or insights over that? Because that is my big worry as well, that we just suddenly back in our offices and buildings and we just slip very quickly back into those old ways of working. And having spoke to lots of people about this, I've never heard anybody sort of list out some of the challenges of the old ways of working quite so powerfully and clearly as you did a few questions ago. So really intrigued to know your thoughts around that one.
Yeah, I think the first thing I would say is to go back and be realistic about how the world of work looked before the pandemic and not kid ourselves that the world of work that we had created over the last decades was all perfect. It was far from it. As I said, many issues and trends which were all pointing in the wrong direction and frankly, simply not sustainable. And then, as you said, I mean, it intrigues me because at the beginning of this pandemic, I think a lot of people, including government, seemed to think that we would get through this and we'd all be back by the summer. Do you remember that? I mean, we'd all started in March.
Yeah.
And everybody thought, right, well, we'll be back in the offices in summer. And so many people saying, well, that's great. And then that'll be all over and we'll be back to doing what we were doing. The longer this has gone on, the more in sort of somewhat paradoxical way, I've felt encouraged in the sense that you can't continue to really to believe that if we've managed to work in these ways, for, as you said, what will amount to at least 18 months. And I know in the grand scheme of things, 18 months may not sound like a lot, but I profoundly believe actually it is a very significant amount of time. And we need to see it like that and recognize so what we've learned. So what I was talking about a forum yesterday, and somebody asked me that same question. They said, look, I'm talking to my leaders in my organization at the moment, and they seem to think that we should all absolutely just go back to what we were doing before, and why wouldn't we? And what would I do about it? And I said, well, I would do two things. One, I would draw out all of your insight, your thoughts, your beliefs on what we needed to get right from before the pandemic, as I said, these trends of work. But secondly, if you really have a leader that believes that everybody wants to just go back to work like they were before, then for heaven's sake, go ask the employees, go survey them. I mean, any business should have been doing this during this pandemic. They should have been talking to their people, surveying them, whatever, and saying, what's working for you, what's not? As we look ahead, what would you most like to take forward from what we have learned? And how would you like to see the world of work that would be really supportive of you as an individual and us as an organization, and how we balance all these different ideas? So I said, go out and talk to the people and survey them. And I would be astonished if they all came back and said what your leader seems to be saying, that we should all be going back to what we did before. So I think those are the, it's so often, isn't it, about many of these questions, particularly, and this has been part of the challenge for a lot of these discussions about corporate cultures and leadership and behaviors and what HR does and doesn't do, because we often haven't had good data points. And so many of our leaders over the generations have been brought up in a very sort of analytical way. And I remember, just to illustrate the point, talking to a business leader not long ago who said, the trouble is with HR is you bring too much PowerPoint and not enough Excel. And I said, well, yeah, I understand your point. We need to be better on the analytics and the data. But I said also, don't believe for a moment that you can run an organization entirely with quantitative facts and figures about things like your culture and the behaviors of the organization, all these other things we've been talking about. So we've got to get better at the data, but it's both qualitative and quantitative. I mean, they've got to help educate leaders who may still be stuck in a paradigm where they think the only thing that counts are things like cost and profit, and that I just look at people as cost, and I'm trying to maximize my profit, and not understanding all of these other critical dimensions of an organization, of its people, its cultures, and so forth, which ultimately will drive your profit. And you need to get those things by doing things like talking to people, listening to them effectively, building this qualitative view of the organization alongside the quantitative. So you truly have a balanced perspective. So as I said, I think like so much in life, you've got to build that picture. You've got to get the evidence, qualitative and quantitative. And then you confront the leaders, if that's what's needed, to say, this is where we were before. This is what we've learned through the pandemic. And this is what everybody's saying about what we need to be looking at for the future. And if we combine all of those things, how could you then possibly believe that all we need to do is forget everything we've done in the last 18 months and just go back to doing what we were doing before?
Yeah, thank you, Peter. And following on from that, I guess this is looking at things on a slightly more practical or detailed level. What challenges do you think, and other CIPD looking at, that might occur when people do start walking back into the office buildings again? And how can leaders be preparing for those? And to give you an example of what I'm thinking about here is sort of my first career was in the army, and it was a sad truth that when we returned from, say, a six-month deployment overseas, there would often be quite a lot of relationships and marriages break down. And that was often because the partner who had stayed at home suddenly became much more independent, got used to being on their own, kind of doing everything for themselves and the family themselves. And on a very granular level, I think the couple started to do things that really annoyed each other and would rub each other up the wrong way, which in some cases became sort of irreparable. And it occurred to me that a similar thing could start to happen when we suddenly find ourselves sitting back at a bank of eight desks in the office, surrounded by lots of colleagues. It suddenly will feel quite different to what we've been used to for 18 months. So is there anything there that kind of you are starting to think about and work on that leaders and HR departments could be thinking about?
Yeah, I mean, they're all really important points, Ben, and I think it's an interesting analogy that you draw. I mean, we don't yet know some of the more difficult aspects of the pandemic. I mean, the kind of things that you're describing there, so the sort of family dynamics that have been changed dramatically, as you said, by having, you know, the father or the mother around much more, and the issues of social isolation that's been created. And you know, it's one thing, which is why I started the podcast by saying I recognize I'm lucky in terms of the lockdown. It's one thing for somebody like myself who've got space to work without getting interrupted. I don't have young children. And my girls are grown up. I've got two of them. I've got three girls, two of them working at home, which has been great. But there are many, many people in very, very different circumstances, you know, working in a much more constrained environment with, you know, lots of interruptions, maybe much and very changed dynamic with their partners, all of those sorts of things. And we do know that there's growing evidence now of massively increased levels of poor mental health and depression, things of that nature. We work a great deal on the mental well-being agenda. It's such an important one. And we work with groups like Mind, and there's growing evidence, as I said, of what the lockdown has done, you know, from social isolation, all those other dynamics I've described. And that has, you know, the word I've used is it creates a shadow. So the pandemic will be creating quite a long-term shadow in terms of things like mental health and well-being. And maybe, you know, more breakdowns of marriages and relationships than we've perhaps yet seen. We also, of course, have other shadows which will come from the pandemic with increased levels of unemployment and all of those issues. So those are big, big questions which play back into the kinds of things you're describing, which is very much about sort of emotional and mental health of many, many people. And then coming back into the workplace, it's kind of interesting. I mean, you know, we've been talking increasingly about, as young people go back to school, that to begin with, there's a sense of trepidation because we've all sort of worked in a particular way. And then all of a sudden you're going to go back to the work environment. And some people are nervous about it, not just because of, will I be safe back in the work environment and traveling there and all those sorts of things, which of course things every employer has to pay real attention to. But you know, back to the stresses of inter-office politics or whatever it might be, which is why, again, I think it's important to give people choice. So I think we've got to be very aware of having how we make that transition back in the right ways. And as I said, it's got to begin with explaining to everybody these principles of how we want to work. We want to give people more choice and flexibility. And just because, yeah, if everything goes according to plan, that in June we can all go back to offices does not mean to say that the message is, right, I want to see you all back in the office. I think I'm speculating here, there may be a couple of effects that we see. One could be that a lot of people actually do begin by saying, gosh, yeah, I do want to go back to the office, because if nothing else, we've recognized the social connection of office work as an important part of why we go to work. Obviously, there'll be a lot of people who just want to see some of their colleagues they haven't been with for a long time. And there will be many people who've joined an organization during the lockdown who've not seen any of their colleagues at all. So there could well be, you know, an effect in the summer where a lot of people do go back to the office initially for those kinds of reasons, whereas there are maybe others who are saying, gosh, you know, I'm not sure I really want to go back to the office, and I don't want to feel forced to go back to the office. So I think that this thought of this shadow, it's going to take a little bit of time for this all to work through. So another very important message, I think, for all of us is to recognize that we need to start with some good principles. So principles that we believe people should be given more choice. We want to take forward the lessons from the pandemic. We want to create more flexible learning opportunities. We want to really address the issues of stress and well-being, make sure there's a front and center. All those things we want to carry forwards as principles. But we don't have the manual as to how to do all of this stuff. So what we need to do is to create enough flexibility to learn as we go. And I really believe that. I think we're going to have to learn a lot as we go about these transitions back into these new ways of working and what really works for everybody, including, of course, how we configure our offices, how we use office space, how we might make sure that we can give people more flexibility in their work schedules so they're not all commuting to work at the same time. And so it goes on. So there's a lot to be thought about there, Ben, in terms of everything from, you know, guarding on these issues of people's well-being and mental health all the way through to the logistics and practicalities of working in these sort of hybrid ways. But as I said, I think we won't know the answers to all of those things initially. And we have to create that opportunity as organizations and as leaders to very much, as I said, to learn as we go as well.
Yeah, I think that's really helpful. I think the idea that we're going to have to learn as we go, be flexible and try and be guided by some core principles rather than sort of very firm plans and roadmaps.
Mm.
Peter, I'd love to finish with a few slightly more quickfire questions if we can. Coming back to focus on you a little bit more as a leader, if we may, what have you been doing over the past 12 months to really keep your team at the CIPD motivated, energized, and on top of the phrase that's being used, pandemic fatigue?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the first thing I'd say is what I hear from a lot of leaders is communicating way more than we ever have done before, because we've had to. I mean, obviously people, particularly in times of crisis, do look to their leaders and try and understand, so what are they thinking, what are they going to do, how are they reacting? So the first thing I'd say without doubt is massively increased the communications from myself through my own leadership team and through the organization. And being able to acknowledge what we know, what we don't know, what we're working on, what we're trying to understand, and so forth. So, you know, again, one of those characteristics of modern leadership, which is so important, which is often described as a basic humility. And it's fascinating to me to go back to some of the early parts of the conversation that you think back to, you know, what I sometimes describe as 20th century leadership, which was very much about the leader in control and in charge and knows what to do and telling everybody else what to do, towards a world which increasingly has been emerging with all this uncertainty that how can I possibly know as a leader what everything that's going on? And if I tried to pretend that I did, people would look at me like, well, obviously you don't know what you're doing because you're trying to pretend that you do. And then you come into the pandemic and, you know, so many of the things that we had been taken for granted suddenly changing. So communicating much more, being much clearer on what we do understand and what we don't, recognizing there's a lot of uncertainty and that I don't know all the answers, none of us do. But what we've got to do is keep connecting, keep communicating, and then to look after each other, putting, as I said, this idea of well-being very, very front and center. And in my weekly video updates that I was doing for so much of the pandemic, I talk about all these things all the time. And then having many more of these sort of town hall calls and encouraging connection right throughout the organization. And those are really powerful things. Now, we won't necessarily need to keep up quite that pace of communication, but I think it's certainly taught us that above all things about this importance of connecting, of communicating, of sharing, of listening. And that idea, as I said, which I think is an absolute fundamental anyway of modern leadership, is showing humility, what we do know, what we don't know, and what we're trying to figure out and how we need to listen to each other and bring strengths of other people to complement where we don't have all of the strengths as individuals or as organizations, so that we are, you know, building our route through all of this uncertainty in a collective and a collaborative way. And I think I don't see there's any other way that you can do these things. And it does strike me also, as you know, as we've moved beyond the pandemic, of not trying to write loads and loads of rules like we know what we're all going to be doing, but to drive much more from a sense of principles. And that is something I've long believed and long talked about, that we need to drive businesses more from principles of what we believe, our values, our purpose, the principles of things that we think are important, and less from great long lists of rules and policies and practices. And that, you know, again, has been a characteristic of business so much in the past and reflected the command and control stuff. And certainly, as we emerge from the pandemic, if we have learned nothing else other than that you can't write rules for everything, there are these, I mean, although I don't think actually the pandemic was a black swan event in strict terms, nonetheless, there are these big existential crises that happen, and you have to adapt, and you've got to learn as you go, and you've got to anchor that on principles and less on well, here's the rules and this is what I'm going to tell everybody to do, or that how many times we've heard it from leaders in the past, say, well, of course, I've seen all this before and this is what we're going to go do. And anybody that says stuff like that now, you know, frankly, does not deserve the trust of their organizations.
Yeah, hear, hear. And Peter, what are one or two books that have really had a big impact upon you or maybe helped shape you as the leader you are today?
Yeah, there are lots of things, I suppose. I mean, in terms of books, I love stuff like Daniel Kahneman's Thinking Fast and Slow, because I'm really, really fascinated, as I said, by people behavior, how they think and so forth. And what I like about what Daniel Kahneman has done, and he won the Nobel Prize for Economics, even though he was actually by training a psychologist, and therefore one of the godfathers, if you will, or founding fathers of behavioral economics. I think that's a really, really interesting space where we're finally bringing together both the qualitative and the quantitative, the idea that people are not rational, and yet you think about so much of economics and business thinking, certainly of the last century, is it was based very much on this idea that of rationality. People are rational. You just write the rules to get rid of the irrational behaviors, and you put them in boxes and you tell them what to do. That is not human. It's not how people work. It's not how you get the best out of them. And I think, yeah, where Kahneman takes the thinking and is to link so much of those ideas of what drives behavior and this system one, system two thinking, the emotional reaction of system one that dominates so much of our behavior and our biases and everything else, and how you link that with, you know, the rational world of economics. And so that's a sort of very core philosophy in a way, which summarizes a lot of, I think, how we're trying to think about now. There are many other books which I've read, which I enjoy. I've enjoyed Dan Pink's book, Drive, or The Surprise of Truth About What Motivates Us. I've loved books like Freakonomics, which also link to these ideas of irrationality and that the world is not rational as we tried to describe it so often in the past. A lot of things like that. But I've also been influenced by many people. I've had the great privilege, both in this job and previous jobs, to meet many, many different people and talk about these things. So I'm actually just at the concluding point of writing a book myself on so many of these things about the trends in work, and it's going to be called The New Era of Work. But all these things that, you know, we've covered a little bit on this podcast, many other things besides. So I've been influenced by many people. I've been influenced, of course, by my own leaders and what I've learned from them, both good and bad, through my career. But I'm I suppose, in terms of another way that I like to think, is I am inherently and innately curious. And I think every leader at any level should be curious, particularly at these times when there's so much uncertainty and there's so much that we can and should learn. There are so many paradigms of work and ways we thought in the past that need challenging and need changing. And you're never going to do those things. You're never going to be able to operate in an uncertain world unless you are curious. You go out and question, you recognize what you don't know, and you seek to gain new understanding and new insight. And whether it's some of the, you know, the people I've already mentioned, or, you know, Thomas Piketty is another, I think, great example of somebody who's challenging, again, as an economist, a lot of thinking about what the world really looks like today and how we need to change some of our thinking. So, as I said, I'd summarize in many ways, Ben, by just that idea of curiosity. And I love reading history books and economics books, and I'm fascinated by physics and technology and all those other things. And I honestly do believe, particularly in today's world, that we should encourage curiosity in everybody and encourage people to go out and learn and read and listen and meet other people and network, because doing that will make us better people and make us better leaders and help help us as leaders to guide others as well.
Peter, I think that note around curiosity enabling us to be better leaders, better people, better colleagues, better humans is a wonderful note to wrap up our conversation on. I just want to conclude by saying a huge thank you for joining us on the show today. And as a long-standing member of the CIPD, also just take a note to thank you for your great work leading the organization over the past, I think it's eight years, and your stewardship of the profession. So thank you very much on several counts.
No, thank you, Ben, and it's been a pleasure to talk to you.
I hope you found that interview as insightful as I did, folks. And if you did, and if you're enjoying the show, please do take a moment to rate, review, and subscribe. It really does help us continue to keep bringing you more and more interviews with amazing leaders like Peter. Do also take a moment to click on the link in the show notes and check out my new online program, Personal Leadership Mastery. It's designed to help you get back on an even footing and lead your team to greater success even more consistently. And remember as well, as a thank you for listening to the podcast, I'm offering you that exclusive Friends 30 code that will take 30% off the retail price at the checkout. That's it for this episode, folks. Stay safe, stay well, and lead on.